Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to summarize some of the big predictions that could dominate the next 10 years. When you look back at the last 10 years, you can look at all the enormous discoveries and marvels that we had. I mean, 10 years ago, the internet, cell phone technology, telecommunications were just getting off the ground, and now they're very much a part of everyday life. But what about the next 10 years? Well, in the beginning of Exploration, we're going to make a series of predictions, some hits, some misses, but predictions about what the future will hold in the coming decade. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. We're very glad to have with us Nobel laureate Henry Pollack of the University of Michigan. He was on that group with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that won the Nobel Prize in Peace. And he's the author of a new book called A World Without Ice. Imagine a world of the future which is totally ice-free. And you begin to realize the enormous hazard that faces us if global warming runs amok. Well, let's begin with today's program where we're going to do a little crystal balling. It's always dangerous to do this. After all, it was Yogi Berra who once said that prediction is awfully hard to do, especially if it's about the future. Well, that's what we're today about the future of astronomy and space travel, the future of medicine, the future of energy, and the future of artificial intelligence. First of all, the future of astronomy. Many astronomers think that within 10 years, in fact, even less than that, we will in fact discover a twin of the Earth in outer space. A small, rocky planet just like the Earth that has liquid water oceans. Already, we have analyzed 400 extrasolar planets orbiting other star systems in the universe. And the question is, well, do any of them resemble the Earth? So far, the answer is no. The closest we have come so far is a planet that is about 2.7 times bigger than the Earth. However, even though it is a rocky planet and it has water on it, lots of water, the water is in the form of steam, not liquid water. Liquid water is the universal solvent. It's the amniotic fluid out of which the first DNA molecule got off the ground. That's why detectives sometimes say follow the money. However, astronomers say follow the water. So within the next few years, well before the end of the decade, we expect to find a twin of the Earth in outer space. And speaking about outer space, bad news for the manned space program. There simply isn't enough money to send astronauts back to the moon by 2020. We're going to miss that deadline. NASA says that it simply does not have enough money to go to the moon and onto Mars. In fact, NASA needs about $30 extra billion just to reach the moon, perhaps by 2025. So for you space enthusiasts out there, you can expect to find a reduced set of goals for NASA. NASA says that perhaps we'll send astronauts to an asteroid. Now, that may be worthwhile. The asteroid Apophis is going to come whizzing around the Earth in the year 2029 and then repeat for another visit in 2036. There is a small chance that it may actually hit the Earth in 2036, about one chance in 100,000. But scientists say that maybe when Apophis comes around in 2029, we should land on that asteroid. That asteroid is about 1,000 feet across, is about the size of the Rose Bowl Stadium. So if you want a mental image of that, think of the Rose Bowl, a large football stadium, and it's about that size. If it hits the Earth, probably it won't, but if it hits the Earth, it could cause enormous amount of havoc. This is not a city buster that can just wipe out New York or Washington, D.C. This is a country buster. An impact would wipe out an area the size of France. So let us hope that we perhaps can land on that asteroid in 2029, but let's hope that it doesn't hit us when it comes back in 2036. Also, speaking about basic science, the Large Hadron Collider is up and running after a very bad year. Last year, there was a disastrous leak of liquid helium into the Atom Smasher, causing the destruction of many magnets and a delay of a full year. However, now it is officially the most powerful machine of science ever created in the history of science. It's smashing protons at a trillion electron volts, beating out the machine that is based outside Chicago. So the Large Hadron Collider, we think, will find the Higgs boson. In fact, that's a bet for the coming decade. In fact, even before then, we expect to find the elusive Higgs boson, the last missing particle in what is called the Standard Model of Particles. However, we want to go beyond that. Within 10 years, we expect to find dark matter. Dark matter makes up 23% of the universe. We, made out of atoms, only make up 4% of the universe. In fact, the higher atoms beyond hydrogen and helium only make up about 0.04% of the universe. So most of the universe is invisible. It's dark, dark energy, dark matter, and we hope to produce this exotic form of matter with the Large Hadron Collider. So that would disprove every single textbook in the Earth that says the world is mainly made out of atoms. The world is not mainly made out of atoms. The world is mainly made out of dark matter and dark energy, and we hope to produce some with the Large Hadron Collider. I'm particularly intrigued by this because the leading theory of dark matter is that it's a higher vibration of the superstring, and that's what I do for a living. Superstring theory, that's my day job. We hope to have a theory of everything that would explain not just matter, but dark matter as well in outer space. Also on the medical front, we expect to continue a series of breakthroughs in medicine, however, a few setbacks as well. One huge setback in the health debate is the question of obesity. It is basically out of control in the United States. People are getting heavier and heavier. You can see it just by looking around or going on an airplane as people try to squeeze into their seats. And this means that there will be a demographic earthquake as more and more people come down with diseases linked to obesity, such as diabetes, cancer, heart disease, a whole series of such diseases, which basically are linked to health and to lifestyle. Also, the Human Genome Project is up and running, and personalized genomes may be available in the coming years. Right now, it costs about $50,000 to have every single gene in your body sequenced. In the coming years, it should go down to about $1,000. Beyond that, within this decade, perhaps a few $100. This means that everyone will have an owner's manual for their body. They'll be able to see exactly which diseases they are predisposed to having, and they'll also be able to trace their ancestral roots going back not just a few years, but perhaps 10,000 years into the past. Also, the Human Body Shop could be up and running. Right now, on an experimental basis, scientists have been able to take tissues from your own body and create blood vessels, bone, cartilage, noses, ears, heart valves. The first bladder was grown a few years ago from a woman's own cells. The first windpipe was actually grown last year. And within a few more years, we expect the first liver to be grown. And in fact, a whole series of organs are now being looked at because scientists believe that we can create copies of these organs that your body won't reject. What scientists do is they take a plastic sponge-like material, seed it with your own cells, hit it with certain growth factors so that it proliferates inside this mold, and then the mold disappears, is biodegradable, leaving a perfect nose or a perfect ear. Cartilage is also possible, which means that people in the future, if they have arthritis, it might be possible to remove the damaged cartilage and insert new cartilage that won't be rejected by the body. Also, remember Star Trek, the old Star Trek where they have the tricorder that allows you to basically see inside a body and diagnose instantly what's wrong? Well, we're going to have a version of the tricorder in the coming years. Portable MRI scans are coming, DNA chips. In the future, whenever you use the bathroom, it automatically analyzes your cells to see whether or not you have cancer colonies growing in your body, not a tumor, By the time you get a tumor, you already have about 10 billion cells growing in your body. It's really too late at that point. Surgery is required immediately. I'm talking about a time when you may have 100 cancer cells growing in your body. We'll be able to have DNA chips that are so sensitive, they'll be able to pick up the telltale proteins and signs of cancer colonies, perhaps 10 years before they can form a tumor. So in the future, your bathroom, your toilet, your bathroom mirror will have more computing power than a modern hospital today, and it will pick up signs of a cancer tumor years before it becomes a tumor, meaning that the word tumor could gradually disappear from the English language. Also, on the energy front, the good news and the bad news. The bad news is that the Earth is continuing to heat up. This past decade was the hottest decade ever recorded in the history of science. Nations are still bickering about who's going to foot the cost, what are we going to do about global warming. So the bad news is that we are in a political mess. China last year surpassed the United States as now the largest producer of carbon dioxide. And of course, India is going to be not too far behind as it industrializes. And that's going to put an enormous strain on the atmosphere of the planet Earth. So the nations of the world simply don't have their act together. That's the bad news. However, there is some good news to this. First of all, the price of solar hydrogen keeps on dropping. Renewable technologies are not yet at the point where they can beat fossil fuels. However, it's getting very close. I think that within 10 years, 15 years at the maximum, the price of solar hydrogen will drop to the point that it will cross the curve for the rising costs of fossil fuels. So when the declining cost of solar hydrogen intersects with the rising cost of fossil fuels, then there's going to be a sea change. The tipping point will take place, and at that point, it will be quite economical to go solar. Not to mention the fact that the plug-in hybrid car is coming. About 50% of energy use goes into transportation, and transportation, of course, burns up huge quantities of oil. But plug-in hybrids are going to be hitting the market very soon. A plug-in hybrid has the advantage that for the first 50 or so miles, it uses an electric battery. Then if you go beyond that, as a backup, there's an internal combustion engine. But for the first 50 miles, that's when people do most of their commuting, most of their grocery shopping, most of their errands are done within 50 miles, in which case you could go completely electric. However, there's a catch there. There's always a catch someplace. And that is, where does the electricity come from? Ultimately, the electricity comes from a power plant. And where do power plants get their electricity? Well, in the short term, it's coal. And coal produces copious quantities of carbon dioxide. So don't be lulled to sleep thinking that the plug-in hybrid is going to save us, because the plug-in hybrid gets its energy from coal. And coal produces an enormous amount of carbon dioxide. However, there are various strategies being designed to cope with this. One short-term strategy is perhaps carbon dioxide sequestration. That's still in the experimental stage. We don't know whether you can really take carbon dioxide from a coal plant and deep six it deep into the Earth's crust. Another possibility is fusion power. Fusion power, well, let's face it, that generates some snickers among the average person. We've heard that before. We've heard it, we've been there, and it don't work yet. However, there are two fusion reactors that have a chance. One is the NIF, the National Ignition Facility, built by the Pentagon. It is, of course, a military device. It has the possibility of perhaps maybe even this year attaining break-even, that is, creating more energy than it consumes. It consists of 192 laser beams that concentrate trillions of watts on a tiny little pellet smaller than the head of a pin. Temperatures are reached that are hotter than the inside of the sun. 100 million degrees Fahrenheit. That's the temperature that this tiny little pellet is heated to. And so in some sense, you have a small hydrogen bomb going off. It's not dangerous because it is smaller than the head of a pin. And it could be the prototype for a working fusion reactor. Another reactor is to be built in France to go online around 2018, called the ITER reactor, an experimental design that uses hydrogen gas that is compressed and heated inside a donut-shaped magnetic field. So it's still a dark horse, but some people think that perhaps by mid-century we may have fusion. So in other words, the danger period could be the next 10 years. 10, 15 years. That's when we still generate lots of carbon dioxide. But then we reach the tipping point. At that point, solar power, renewables, wind power, geothermal power start to kick in. And perhaps by mid-century, the era of solar power could be dawning. Of course, it's not a shoo-in at all, but there is some hope out there. It's not totally hopeless if the cost of solar hydrogen keeps on dropping. And one last prediction. You've all seen those movies like the Terminator movie and the Transformer movie. One prediction is that we're not going to have a true robot, a true automaton that acts like a human being in this decade. There's simply not enough computer power, not enough understanding, not enough software written to explain the intricacies of the human mind. So one prediction is that we're not going to have true robots, true automatons that you can gossip with, that think creatively just like a human being. We're not going to have them within 10 years. Of course, we're going to have more and more robots in the home. Robots that can vacuum the floor, do simple chores around the home, automatic devices. But they're going to be like tape recorders, sophisticated tape recorders, rather than true humans. So in other words, we humans aren't going to be replaced anytime soon. I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have a Nobel laureate, Henry Pollack, a professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and he's the author of a new book called World Without Ice. He was part of that group that won the Nobel Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The Nobel Prize in Peace was given to that organization, and he was one of the main authors of that pivotal report on global warming. So what would it be like to live in a world without ice? I guarantee you it's not a world that you want to live in. So once again, our special guest today is Nobel laureate Henry Pollack. Professor Pollack, how did you as a child first get interested in science?
I grew up during World War II, and every day in the newspaper, there were maps of the front in Europe and in Asia and the Pacific. And I just grew very fond of maps and looking at the geography around the globe. And that, in a sense, I think is characteristic of all of my adult research interests, trying to stand back and get a global viewpoint, not just of climate science, but in all the scientific endeavors that I've been involved with in a long career, I've always tried to get a global perspective.
And why geophysics, and specifically, why the weather?
Well, I've not always been interested in the climate. I'm actually not a meteorologist, but my focus on the world's weather really is in the world's climate, which is the long-term average of what the weather gives us. And that's only an interest that has developed in the last two decades. Prior to that, I had done research in seismology, study of earthquakes. I've done work in taking the Earth's temperature to measure the amount of heat coming out from the interior and its relationship to earthquakes and volcanism. But in the last decade and a half or so, I realized that the rock temperatures that I had been taking for other purposes was also telling us something about what's happening at the Earth's surface. And we were able to reanalyze a lot of that data and reconstruct what the surface temperature of the Earth looked like for about the past 500 years which conveniently takes us into the pre-industrial era. So there have been many transitions in my scientific interest. All of them, of course, are within the broad realm of Earth science.
Okay, now let's talk about ice. Why is ice so important? Some people say, ha, nothing but polar bears and penguins. Why ice?
Well, ice is important, and the number one reason that it's important is that it plays a big role in the global climate system. Ice is a white substance, and it's very reflective. And the more ice there is on the planet, the less sunshine warms the Earth because it is reflected directly back to space. With less ice, more sunshine falls on the solid Earth and warms us up. So the amount of ice is a very big player in how much sunshine the Earth absorbs.
And
the second reason that ice is important is that it's a very sensitive and unambiguous indicator of climate change, because ice on our planet is very close to its melting point. Small changes in the temperature cause very visible changes in the amount and geography of ice on the planet. And so it is what I call nature's best thermometer, because it is very, very sensitive to climate change. And then the third reason that ice is important, because as you lose it, important things happen on Earth. The first ice to go will be the mountaintop glaciers in the tropics and the mid-latitudes. And those glaciers today provide agricultural and domestic water to almost a third of Earth's population. That's a very large number of people who rely on that water for their well-being. And the other aspect, of course, of melting ice is that the water eventually runs into the ocean and raises sea level. It's not the only factor that raises sea level. The warming of the ocean water also leads to sea level rises. But sea level rising will, in simple terms, produce climate refugees, and that will be a very serious social problem as we displace people from the coastal regions.
And doesn't ice also help to regulate the weather? When we watch the weather in the evening, we see the jet stream coming from the Arctic. So doesn't all that huge mass of cold air also help to regulate the world's weather?
Well, it does indeed. I would in no way minimize the importance of ice in our daily affairs as reflected through the weather. My emphasis has been on the longer-term trends, which we interpret in terms of slow climate change.
Okay, now let's take a look at the data. What evidence do we have that ice is thinning, that glaciers are receding, and what about ice cores that can take us hundreds of thousands of years back into the past?
Well, let's talk first about the evidence for ice receding. We have photographic evidence of mountain glaciers around the globe taken from the times when the camera was first available in the 19th century, more or less, that show the position of ice in glacial valleys. And throughout the decades, and in fact throughout the 20th century, there are many repeat photographs of glaciers. And so you can just visibly see them receding in their valleys. So it's just visual photographic evidence of that loss of ice. Now, in the Arctic region, the sea ice in the Arctic is simply frozen seawater. We call that sea ice, and it's not very thick. It's on the order of 5 to 10 feet, sometimes a little more than that. But in the summertime, it tends to break up some, and then in the wintertime, it refreezes. But the extent of the summertime breakup has been changing dramatically in the last few decades. We have now only about half the area of sea ice in the summer that we had in the middle of the 20th century, and it's getting thinner as well. The average thickness of sea ice in the Arctic is only half of what it was a half century ago. And so we're faced with the prospect of perhaps an Arctic Ocean that is free of ice in the summertime in just a few decades. So that, too, is a very visible change. There, the observations come from satellites that can look down over the entire Arctic. Now, you asked about the ice cores. Ice cores are a form of sedimentary rock, if you like to think of that, because they have layers that form each year from new snowfall. And as next year's snowfall falls on top of that, it compresses the layers underneath it into ice. And so we have a layer-by-layer, year-by-year history locked up in the ice. But in the case of the Antarctic, the record is almost 800,000 years long. And we are able to tease out of the chemistry of the ice the temperature at which the snow fell at that given year. And another very interesting aspect of those ice cores is that as the snow is compacted and recrystallized into ice, it traps little bubbles of air, which are samples of the atmosphere at the time that the snow fell. And so we are able to chemically analyze the atmosphere year by year, going back almost a million years, to recover the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere over long periods of time. What we've learned from that is that the concentration of greenhouse gases today is well beyond the range of natural variability over the past 800,000 years. The ups and downs that Earth's climate has experienced in the last 800,000 years have never gone as high in carbon dioxide as the concentration in the atmosphere is today. So it reveals that we're in the middle of a big inadvertent experiment with the chemistry of the atmosphere and its effects on the global climate that humans have just recognized and are now having to cope with.
And isn't it true that carbon dioxide levels and temperature levels in these ice cores are like two roller coasters in tandem going up and down almost simultaneously over hundreds of thousands of years?
You're absolutely right. That's a wonderful description of it. And what the significance of that is that the temperature of the atmosphere and the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere are very closely coupled. And when one moves, it will pull the other along with it. And in the present day, what is doing the tugging is that we have increased the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dramatically, and it is now pulling the temperature along with it. And that's, of course, what we're recognizing as global warming.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest today is Nobel laureate Henry Pollack of the University of Michigan. He won the Nobel Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Be sure to tune in every Tuesday at 10 o'clock for Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible, a weekly series that I host for the Science Channel. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration. Welcome back to Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first part of Exploration, we began a discussion with Professor Henry Pollack of the University of Michigan. He's a Nobel laureate winning the Nobel Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And in the second half, we're going to continue a discussion of a world without ice. What does it mean if every single glacier on the planet Earth is receding? What does it mean if Greenland starts to break up and melt? What does it mean if we see the beginnings of the hemorrhaging of the South Pole? What does it mean if sea levels begin to rise? What about civilization? What about the coastline of the world? Well, these are some of the questions we're going to ask as we discuss what it means to live in a world without ice with Nobel laureate Henry Pollack. Now, Professor Pollack, where we last left off, we were talking about the poles of the Earth. So let's now discuss the South Pole. We hear reports of gigantic parts of the pole breaking off the size of, let's say, the state of Rhode Island. Could you elaborate?
Sure, I could. There is a lot of ice on Antarctica. It has probably 90% of the global ice. And it is stacked up in places almost 10,000 feet thick and spilling off of the continent and into the sea and building up pools of ice called ice shelves. And these ice shelves are big. You mentioned the size of Rhode Island. Actually, the Ross Ice Shelf on the New Zealand side of Antarctica is as big as France. So these are huge pools of ice. And what we're discovering, what we're observing, is that these ice shelves are becoming unstable and breaking up and dislodging huge amounts of floating ice into the ocean currents around Antarctica. And this ice loss is at a pace that we've not seen before in human history. And so you're looking at instability. The understanding of what's causing it includes both warming, of course, from above, but the seawater is also warming and undermining these ice sheets from below and leading to their breakup. Once they break up, the glaciers that feed them from the interior no longer have a barrier in front of them, and so the glaciers themselves are now speeding up and spilling more ice into the sea. So we see the whole process accelerating as both the air and the ocean water are warming.
And speaking of a spiral effect, the tundra of Siberia is frozen, but as it thaws out, it releases methane gas, which is even worse than carbon dioxide as a global warming gas. Could you elaborate on a positive feedback if tundra begins to melt and release methane, which then heats up the Earth again?
Well, I certainly can. First, there's no question that the tundra is beginning to melt. There's a term called tundra travel days, which indicate how many days of the year you can drive across the frozen tundra because it is frozen. And that number, the tundra travel days, has been diminishing and is now measured in months, not just days, of reduction in tundra travel time. So there's no question that the tundra is softening up and melting. Methane is coming out. There have been measurements made in Siberia and in Alaska of the release of gases from the frozen tundra, and it does contain a great deal of methane, which is indeed another greenhouse gas, more powerful than carbon dioxide, but also it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. So there is a little bit of a trade-off on that. But the amount of methane that is coming out, as I say, the measurements are just now beginning to be made, and the projections or the models of how this might proceed require that the tundra melt from the top down. And so it's a very slow process of diffusing heat downward into the permafrost. And I guess the good news is that that process, while it will deliver quite a bit of methane, will be spread out over centuries and probably not be a catastrophic release of methane that would lead to an instantaneous enhancement of the greenhouse blanket.
Okay, now let's take a look at the worst-case scenario. Now, remember, this is the worst-case scenario. No one is saying that this is actually going to happen. But the worst-case scenario in 50 years and 100 years, assuming that governments do nothing, that it's business as usual, population grows, economic activity grows. So again, with the caveat that this is a worst-case scenario, 50 years from now, what happens to sea levels? I'm in Manhattan right now. What happens to coastal cities? What happens to the breadbaskets of the world? And then 100 years from now, what are your thoughts?
There are actually three scales, time scales, associated with ice loss. There's the decadal time scale, and in that period of time, the next two or three decades, we're going to see the loss of mountain glaciers everywhere in the world. We're going to see the ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime and the issues associated with opening that up to commercial activity. So that's on the decadal time scale, the loss of mountain glaciers and the summertime Arctic Ocean being free of ice and open for commercial activity. On the century-long time scale, we're talking about losing ice in substantial amounts from Greenland and from West Antarctica. Antarctica actually has kind of two geographic regions, the West and the East. The East has the biggest pile of ice, and the West, a smaller pile of ice about the same size as Greenland itself. Now, both Greenland and West Antarctica, each one has the potential of about 20 feet of sea level rise. If we were to lose the ice from Greenland, sea level would rise 20 feet. If we were to lose the ice from West Antarctica, sea level would rise 20 feet. And any partial loss from both could also equal, many feet. So that is on the century-long time scale. And we're already seeing the early hints of that in the acceleration of ice loss from both Greenland and West Antarctica. Now, the big kahuna in all of this is East Antarctica, which has probably the equivalent of something on the order of 200 feet of sea level rise if we were to lose the ice from East Antarctica. But that ice loss, at least at the moment, seems to be on a millennial time, over 1,000 years or so. So that aspect of it is probably more delayed than in the future. But the century alone could have several feet of sea level rise, and that will be may have very substantial impacts on coastal communities everywhere.
Okay, we had some static there. I guess the static is gone now. Okay, well, we'll edit that static out. Okay.
Okay. Did you want me to comment on New York in particular?
Say a few things about New York and some of the major coastal cities, Boston, New Orleans.
Well, coastal cities everywhere, of course, will be vulnerable to rising sea levels. And you don't need to have 10 feet of sea level rise to have a catastrophe. Just a few feet of sea level rise makes every coastal city more vulnerable to storm surges from what might in the past have been ordinary types of storms and hurricanes. But with higher sea level, everything is more vulnerable. In New York, of course, it's the subway system that is most vulnerable, because once water starts to encroach on Manhattan and the other boroughs, you're going to quickly find you have huge problems with the underground transport system. And there will be aspects of water supply issues that rising sea levels have on coastal communities that draw some of their water from the subsurface. And in areas that have a really flat terrain, such as the major river deltas of the world, particularly those in Asia, the Indus River, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, the Irrawaddy, all those have very flat terrains that just a few feet of sea level rise will lead to inundation many miles inland and displacement of a great number of residents and loss of agricultural land.
And what happens to a nation like Bangladesh?
Well, that's a wonderful, I shouldn't say wonderful, but it's a spectacular example of a very flat country that will suffer widespread inundation and displacement of tens of millions of people. And it's we have some experience with climate refugees in the USA following the Hurricane Katrina flooding of New Orleans. There we have had to address the issues with involving 150,000 people. That will, is such a tiny fraction of the numbers that will be displaced if we have a few feet of sea level rise in Bangladesh, where it will be in the tens of millions. The difficulties we had addressing climate refugees from Katrina will pale compared to the magnitude of the displacement from sea level rise the world over.
Okay, now let's take a look at some of the critics of this phenomenon, including physicist Freeman Dyson at Princeton. He has two criticisms. He first of all says that rising carbon dioxide levels are actually good for plants. Plants will thrive under that situation. And second, more serious, he says that we don't really know how much carbon dioxide is absorbed by the Amazon and by forests and by plants and by algae. And until we have a good handle on the recycling of carbon dioxide through plants, then perhaps these computer models are premature. What are your thoughts?
Well, let me address both of those. The first issue that plants will love it is kind of a facetious response, I think. It is true that carbon dioxide is the food for photosynthesis, and that green plants do take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and metabolize and give us oxygen as a waste product. But it's not that plants need only carbon dioxide to thrive. They need the appropriate amounts of the right kind of nitrogen. They need water availability. And in many, many places and cases, carbon dioxide is not the limiting factor for plant growth. Moreover, it's not only the plants that we might want that will thrive. Well, they'll also see many weeds that will also thrive and in some cases overtake the vegetation that we might be seeking to enhance. A third aspect of it is that even if some agricultural production might increase, it won't always be in the same place that it was previously because the temperatures are changing as well. And so we're going to see displacements, geographic displacements of agriculture, and that alone will be a social disruption across the agricultural world. So I think that far from being a blessing, some people say that it's a return to the Garden of Eden, but it will hardly be the case. There are many, many more factors than just the availability of carbon dioxide. Now, about his reluctance to do anything until we understand better the uptake of carbon dioxide by the forests of the world, I think that's short-sighted. The one thing that we do know is that the forests of the world are not able to take up as much as we're putting into the atmosphere because the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been climbing. As I mentioned earlier, it has climbed out of the range of natural variability of the climate system by a great, great deal. And so whatever the role of the green plants of the Earth are, we're overwhelming them with carbon dioxide far beyond what they're able to take up and leading to warming and melting of ice and rising sea levels. So I think we don't have the luxury of waiting to see how the natural world evolves and how it may help in the take-up. I certainly endorse the idea of storing carbon in plants and in algae, and there are experiments underway for large-scale reforestation and for fertilization of the oceans. But none of these experiments that are underway have given us the promise that we have time to spare, and we can wait and see how they work out. We really don't have that much time to spare because the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is growing well beyond the ability of the natural world to pull it out.
And what do you say to the critics who say that it's just the sun? The sun is getting hotter. What are your thoughts?
Well, as a good scientist, the usual response is that, well, let's examine that possibility. Let's measure the radiative output from the sun across the full spectrum of wavelengths that the sun is sending energy to Earth. And the measurements of that over the last half century have actually shown that the sun's radiant energy delivery to Earth is slightly diminished. And if it was only the sun that was affecting climate, Earth would have actually been cooling some in the last half of the 20th century and the beginning decade of the 21st. But the measurements show that far from cooling, Earth is actually warming. So the proper way of addressing the causes is to ask, what are the likely factors, both natural and anthropogenic, and try and make measurements of each of them, assess their contribution. And when you do that, you quickly discover that the natural factors have fallen short in terms of accounting for the warming of the last half of the 20th century and that continues today. So the sun, of course, plays a big role in Earth's climate, and it always has. And we want to learn as much about the variability of the solar radiation as possible. But the extensive measurements that we have of that energy from satellites that are orbiting above Earth's atmosphere, so we don't have any atmospheric effects or detractions from it, it's showing that the sun has not been behind the warming that we're observing.
And some of the critics say that, okay, the Earth is heating up. They'll admit that now. But then they say that it's not human activity. It's a natural cycle. So do you have any, like, smoking gun that shows that it's human activity and not a natural thing?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I want to, make people who say that acknowledge that there is a possibility of a human signature first. And I'll give you an analogy that I used in that regard. I always ask, were there ever forest fires before there were people on Earth? And the answer, of course, is yes. We know that lightning can start forest fires, and it did that long before there were people. So then I ask, does that mean that all forest fires today are due to lightning? In other words, is all of today's forest fire activity due to a natural cause? And, of course, the answer to that is no. And the reason is that we have a new player in the forest fire system. We have the humans. We have people, who are malicious arsonists. We have people who fail to put their campfires out. We have people who throw cigarettes out the window while they're driving. And we still have lightning, of course. But what that analogy shows is that even though there are natural factors that cause climate change, now we also have the addition of human factors. Now, how do we know? That just admits the possibility that humans are big players. But how do we know that the human signature is the dominant one today? Well, we've quantified both the radiant energy from the sun. We've quantified the amount of volcanic dust in the atmosphere from eruptions in the 20th century. And calculated their effects on climate. We know how much carbon dioxide has gone into the atmosphere, and we know the absorption that takes place of the infrared radiation trying to leave Earth. And when you look at the numbers, both the sun and the volcanic eruptions, part of the natural forcings, certainly are not leading to warming. The one factor that is the greenhouse gas blanket, and that has been growing in effectiveness, growing in thickness, so to speak, and it's simply trapping more heat that's trying to escape from Earth. Now, there's a lot of more subtle fingerprints, as we call them. One is that if there's increased radiation from the sun, that should warm both the upper atmosphere and the lower atmosphere. But if it's warming that's caused by the greenhouse effect, in other words, radiation trying to leave Earth but being trapped, you find that you warm the lower atmosphere more, but you're trapping the heat, and so the upper atmosphere doesn't get its share, and it cools. And so there's a good test. If the whole atmosphere, upper and lower, is warming, you can point to the sun. If only the lower atmosphere is warming, but the upper atmosphere is cooling, that's a fingerprint of greenhouse trapping. And of course, the measurements of temperature show that the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, is cooling. And so that's evidence for the greenhouse effect putting its signature on the temperature of the atmosphere.
Okay. Now the question is, what do we do about it? Former President George W. Bush said that, well, maybe we should do our part, but look at China. China puts a coal plant online every week, one coal plant every week, and it's, well, we should spread the burden. So what about a positive program?
Well, I think that the notion that somehow mitigating greenhouse gases is a penalty or a burden on the economy is a false notion. I think that to the contrary, the factor that will lead to revitalization of the American industrial economy is in fact moving away from the fossil fuels into the renewable energy sources, into conservation and efficiencies, and that any nation that takes the lead in developing the new green technologies is going to be the nation that benefits the most, not the nation that is penalized the most. It's quite the contrary. This is an opportunity, not a penalty that we're facing. And so when you look at the nations of the world and ask who is taking the lead in developing wind energy and solar energy, the U.S., of course, is making some steps, but so is Europe and so is China. And China's announced intention is to become the leader in renewable energy. And so I think we're going to see a great competition as to who can step out first and provide the technologies and the concepts that will lead to a revolution in energy production in the 21st century, an entirely new basis of energy that steps away from carbon, which, of course, fueled the Industrial Revolution and right on through the 20th century. But we need to make a change, and the Earth, people on Earth, didn't move out of the Stone Age because we ran out of stones. They moved out because they found better ways to do things. And I think that likewise, we're going to see a revolution in energy, not because we've run out of coal or petroleum, but because we now recognize that there are many better ways of generating energy. And those nations that take the lead are going to be the ones that benefit strongly from it. So I think the USA should see this as an opportunity, not as a penalty.
Well, the car manufacturers are beginning to look at electric cars, plug-in hybrids, and fuel cell cars. However, the critics say that ultimately the electricity for these cars comes from coal plants. And so even if we have electric cars, coal plants will still be spewing enormous amounts of carbon dioxide as you fuel up by plugging your plug-in hybrid into the wall socket. So what about replacing coal?
Well, I think that there is some truth to say that we're going to see electricity generated in part by coal from power plants that are already in existence. But it doesn't mean that coal has to, that the exhaust from that carbon dioxide has to go unlimited into the atmosphere. We can continue to use carbon-based fuels if we can devise ways to capture the greenhouse gases and not let them into the atmosphere and store the greenhouse gases underground or in the deep ocean. If we continue to use the carbon-based fuels, we have to, at the very same time, develop the technologies that will capture the carbon dioxide and not let it into the atmosphere. So we can have a lot of electricity. And, of course, eventually we're going to see electricity, solar voltaic electricity. We're going to see geothermal electricity. I think we're going to see lots of renewable sources of electricity that will replace the carbon-based fuels that we're using now.
One last question. Some people say that the cost of solar hydrogen is going down, but that there is no one single replacement for oil. We have wind power, we have windmills, we have photovoltaics, but there's no one source of power that's going to be like a white knight that saves us. And in fact, it's probably going to be a very complex mix for many a decade. What are your thoughts?
I think that's right. And I don't think that is something that's ominous and that we should be worried about. It will require that we rethink the nature of our electrical distribution system to allow for multiple and widely distributed generation sources rather than the few concentrated ones which we currently have at the big mega plants that use a lot of coal. It is true that there is no silver bullet that is going to let us easily march into the future with a single new technological breakthrough. We have a lot of technologies that are in their evolutionary stage, some at greater levels of maturity than others. And we right now, to make the transition away from the carbon-based fuels, we need every horse in the stable pulling. We don't have the luxury to say, well, I think wind is better than solar photovoltaics, or I think that the ocean currents are better than geothermal. Everything has certain problems with it now in the developmental stage, but we need them all to be moving ahead simultaneously. As I said, you know, we need every horse in the stable pulling, and it will lead to a future energy environment that is highly complex, with multiple sources that each have their own advantages and disadvantages, but all contribute to the replacement of the carbon-based fuels.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Professor Henry Pollack, Nobel laureate. He won the Nobel Prize for Peace with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And we're talking about his latest book, a very unnerving book, a disturbing book, a book about our future. The book is called World Without Ice. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you get the Science Channel, tune in every week, Tuesdays at 10 o'clock. I host a new series for the Science Channel called Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible, based on my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Impossible. So once again, good day for exploration.